Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight, and happy May Day to you all. Appropriately, our topic for discussion tonight is what is to be done, and we've got two speakers, Andrew Lee and Tony Smith, speaking in that order. They're known to you. I'll introduce them very briefly. They'll speak for about 15 minutes each. The papers of their talks we'll publish will be a bit longer, but tonight they're going to speak for around that, and then we'll have questions and discussion. Andrew Lee graduated in Arts and Law at Sydney University. He has a PhD from Harvard. He worked as an academic, as a ministerial staffer, as a lawyer. He's an author, but most importantly, he's been Labor MHR for Fraser in the ACT since 2010. Tony Smith spoke here once before on the topic of equality some years ago. He graduated in Arts and Commerce from the University of Melbourne. He was a ministerial staffer. He was parliamentary secretary to John Howard, a shadow minister in the opposition years, and of course MHR for Casey in Melbourne since 2001. And both Andrew and Tony have served on various common economic committees of the parliament. And tonight they're going to discuss what is to be done. And so we lead off with Dr. Lee. Many thanks.
Thanks very much, Gerard, and can I begin, of course, by acknowledging we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Indigenous peoples and pay my respects to their elders past and present. To Tony, to Gerard, thank you very much for the honour of addressing the Sydney Institute. Imagine a ladder in which each rung represents $1 million of wealth. Now imagine the Australian population spread out along this ladder with the distance from the ground reflecting their household wealth. On this ladder, half of all Australian households are closer to the ground than they are to the first rung. The typical Australian household is about halfway to the first rung. Someone in the top 10% is 1.5 rungs up. Someone in the top 1% is 5 rungs up. Jenna Reinhart is 5.5 kilometres above the ground. The rich are different from you and me, wrote an awestruck F. Scott Fitzgerald. Yes, wrote the more laconic Hemingway, they have more money. But why should we care about the gap between rich and poor? Shouldn't we focus on raising the bottom rather than how much wealthier the top are than the rest? Aren't discussions of inequality merely the politics of envy? Tonight I want to persuade you that inequality matters, that the gap between rich and poor really is an important public policy issue, even apart from the question of poverty. Inequality has costs and it has benefits, and policymakers need to think hard about the right level of inequality. So to begin, let me take a moment to review what we know about inequality in Australia. There's a plethora of measures of inequality, but I'm going to focus on top income inequality for two reasons. First of all, it allows me to look at a much longer period than any other measure. And secondly, I think it's very clear when we're talking about top incomes that we're talking about inequality and not about poverty. About a decade ago, I teamed up with the Oxford economist Sir Tony Atkinson on a project to use taxation statistics to learn about inequality. While regular surveys are conducted every few years, tax data are available annually, so we can create an estimate of top income inequality that goes back to the 1910s. And the thing that strikes you first of all is that for all the legends of egalitarian bushmen, early 20th century Australia was a strikingly unequal place. I'll come to the data in a moment, but let me remind you first of the character of the place. The Australian Club in Sydney and the Melbourne Club were elite institutions. True, an Australian gentleman, unlike his British counterpart, need not have been a man of leisure. These clubs admitted merchants and squatters from the outset, but great deference was paid to the elite. Large fortunes were made in the late 19th and early 20th century, and the super rich lived extravagantly. Retail merchant Samuel Horden raced yachts and bred racehorses. Gold mining magnate Walter Hall was also a racehorse owner and collected old masters' paintings. Then things began to change. From the 1910s to 1980, the income share of the richest 1% more than halved, while the income share of the richest 0.1%, the richest 1/1000th of Australians, fell by 3/4 from the period when Billy Hughes was Prime Minister to the period when Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister. The collapse of the super rich is vividly portrayed in William Rubinstein's book, The All-Time Australian 200 Rich List. Published in 2004, it covers the all-time richest Australians, from Samuel Terry, the convict Rothschild, through to Kerry Packer, because he's writing in 2004. So because Rubinstein covers 200 people and about two centuries, you would expect an entrant about every year or so. But the striking thing is that for four decades, 1940 to 1980, there isn't a single entrant on the all-time Australian rich list. Not one Australian wealthy enough to make the all-time rich list. Now, the closed economy of the 1950s and 1960s imposed costs on society as a whole. But nonetheless, this is an era marked by full employment for men, rapid increases in the ownership of cars and houses, and significant reductions in poverty. Yet Rubinstein writes that so markedly different were trends among the very rich compared with those for society as a whole, the post-war period seems to constitute, as it were, an age of affluence for everyone except the very affluent. Another writer notes that the wealthy at that time feel under some pressure to be accepted by ordinary working Australians rather than the other way around. The fall in inequality in post-war years wasn't unique to Australia. Right across the Anglosphere, the pattern was very similar. Inequality fell steadily from the 1920s to the 1970s. Among the factors that made all of the English-speaking countries more equal over this period were rising education, high top tax rates, fairly closed economies, and strong unions. And then, starting around 1980, Australian inequality began to rise. Over the past three decades, Tony and I find that the... That's Tony Atkinson, not Tony Smith, I should be clear. Find that the income share of the richest 1% has doubled. The income share of the richest 0.1%, the richest 1/1000th of Australians, has tripled. The ratio of CEO pay to average worker pay has quadrupled. So after being absent from Australian life for nearly four decades, we saw the return of the magnate. In the 1980s, Rupert Murdoch, Kerry Packer, Alan Bond. In the 90s, Frank Lowy, Richard Pratt, Harry Triguboff. In the 2000s, Andrew Forrest, Ivan Glasenberg, Jenna Reinhardt, among others. On the latest BRW rich list, 10 members of that rich list would make the all-time Australian rich list. Since 1980, 13% of household income gains in Australia have gone to the top 1%. The rise in top income inequality is reflected in sales of luxury goods. Prices for waterfront property, great Australian artworks, have soared over recent decades, reflecting their scarcity. Over the past two decades, a bottle of 1971 Grange, which I'm assured is one of the great vintages, has increased in price at three times the rate of average worker earnings. Even cocaine, which Robin Williams once described as God's way of telling you you're making too much money, is being consumed in greater quantities. The super rich also donate more to political parties than ever before. In 2010, Graham Wood gave $1.6 million to the Greens. Clive Palmer gave $1 million to the Coalition, seeking nothing in return but pre-selection for a federal seat. I admit I was a little alarmed when I heard that Mr Palmer intended to buy his way into Parliament, but the new head of the CIA, Bob Brown, assures me that there is nothing to worry about. Three big factors drove the rise in top income inequality over the past generation. First, the returns increased markedly for those at the top of the field, what economists call superstars. Second, union membership collapsed. And third, top tax rates were cut dramatically. But should we care about inequality? Or do we take the view that workplace relations minister Tony Abbott put in 2003? In the end, we have to be a productive and competitive society, and greater inequality might be inevitable. Well, one set of arguments suggests that we should care about inequality for what are called instrumental reasons. Inequality, some contend, is associated with worse outcomes in areas that society cares about. Health, crime, savings, growth. It's an argument I used to believe and one that I desperately want to be true, but my own research in these areas convinces me otherwise. The closer you get to the asserted effects, the more fragile are the findings. If there are negative effects of inequality on these social outcomes, they must be extremely small. I now think a better reason to care about the distribution of incomes is because humans have a palpable discomfort with high levels of inequality. As the father of two young boys, I can attest that my sons are constantly benchmarking one against another. In preparing for this talk, I asked my older son whether he would prefer that he and his brother both got one biscuit, or that his brother got three biscuits and he got two. He chose one apiece. That isn't confined to children. A famous economics experiment is the ultimatum game. In that game, the first player decides how they would like $100 distributed between them and the other person. The second player then chooses whether to accept that division or whether to give all of the money back. So if all we cared about was being better off, then the second player should accept the division that gives them anything at all, because anything is better than nothing. So if the first player proposes to keep $99 and hand over a dollar, a second player who doesn't care about inequality should accept. Yet in thousands of settings, it's been shown that when people have a cut-off of around $25, below which they'd rather get nothing than receive a share they regard as miserly. It offends our dignity. It offends our sense of justice. Anyone who thinks that economics is about maximising money rather than maximising well-being hasn't got past first year. And once you're on to maximising well-being, inequality matters, because a dollar brings more well-being to a poor person than it does to a rich person. There's also practical ways in which an increase in top incomes can reduce well-being for others. If people are competing for positional goods, a home in a desirable suburb, a place in a top university, a sought-after job, then inequality can lead to an expenditure cascade, as those in the middle have to spend more to stay in the race. When top incomes are modest, a young man can happily wear a $200 suit to a job interview. But if top incomes rise, he might feel a need to buy a $1,000 suit to compete for the job. Another reason to care about inequality is that it has the potential to corrode the polity. Campaign contributions themselves aren't a cause for concern, but we need to worry when donations buy policy outcomes that personally benefit the donor. My final concern about high inequality is that unequal societies tend to be immobile societies. When I studied the relationship between the earnings of fathers and sons, I found the degree of intergenerational mobility in Australia was better than the United States, but worse than the Scandinavian nations. A belief in social mobility sits deep in the heart of the Australian national identity. We talk about what a good society should achieve. It's one of the first things that comes to the lips of politicians of all stripes. And yet we know that the more unequal a society, the less socially mobile it is. If high inequality entrenches poverty and plurocracy alike across generations, it might damage something that many of us hold sacred. The super rich in the future are more likely to be inheritors and less likely to be self-made. So what should we do about rising inequality in Australia? Preparing my talk, I went back and read the talks given in 1999 when the Sydney Institute hosted a debate on inequality between Craig Emerson and Julie Bishop. Both argued that education was the key to reducing inequality, and I think it's still the most promising solution. Indeed, we can think about inequality as a race between education and technology. If we improve the quality of Australia's education system, something that Tony is going to speak about, and improve early childhood intervention for the most disadvantaged children, then we'll make a mark on inequality. Targeted welfare matters too. Applying means tests and assets tests to the pension in the 1980s was politically tough, but absolutely essential to the sustainability of the system. Our Labor government's taken politically difficult decisions to impose means tests on the baby bonus, family tax benefit Part B, and the private health insurance rebate. And we also need to recognise, as Ken Henry pointed out in last year's tax forum, that progressive income taxes, not the GST, company taxes or Pigouvian taxes, are the best tool for redistributing income. Egalitarianism sits deep in the Australian character. Most of us tend to think that Jack's as good as his master, if not better. Most of us don't like tipping. If the plumber drops around, we'll offer him a cuppa. It's normal to sit in the front seat of a taxi. I'd say g'day to a cabinet minister as I would to a bus driver. We don't typically say sir to people in Australia. In fact, I enjoy the irony that the only knight that I know is my inequality co-author, Sir Tony Atkinson. In his study of Japanese prisoners of war, Gavin Dawes writes, "I began imagining that if human beings were worked and starved and beaten to the point of death, they would be reduced to barely functioning skeletons, scraps of biology, with all national culture and character trampled out of them. Not so. All the way down to starvation rations, 1,000 calories a day and less, to 100 pounds of body weight and less, prisoners of the Japanese remained inextinguishably American, Australian, British, Dutch." The Americans were the great individualists of the camps, the capitalists, the cowboys, the gangsters. The British hung on to their class structure like bulldogs for grim death. And the Australians, they kept trying to construct little male-bonded welfare states. Unlike Americans, Australians could not imagine doing men to death by charging interest on something as basic to life as rice. That was blood-sucking. It was murder. Within little tribes of Australian enlisted men, rice went back and forth all the time. But this wasn't trading in commodities futures. It was sharing. It was Australian tribalism. My grandfather turns 90 this year. And for most of his life, Australia has steadily been becoming a more egalitarian place. It's only been in the last few decades that we've seen a rise in inequality, now creeping back up to where it was in the Great Gatsby era into which my grandfather was born. The risk is that too much inequality will destroy Australia's egalitarian spirit. There's many things about the 1950s and 1960s we would not want to keep. But one value worth trying to reclaim about that era was the sense of egalitarianism. Too much inequality strains the social fabric, threatening to cleave us, one from another, Australia is a stronger nation when we act together than when we pull apart.
Thank you, Jared and Anne, for the opportunity to speak this evening. To my colleague from the other side of the Parliament, Andrew Lee, thank you for your address. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. Jared's choice of topic is both profound and provocative. I expect, at least I should say, I hope that Vladimir Lenin is spinning in his Kremlin mausoleum on the news that a bastion of free enterprise like the Sydney Institute has co-opted the title of his infamous Bolshevik Manifesto. And as Jared pointed out at the start, to add insult to injury, we're all meeting here on May Day itself. The very breadth of our theme, what is to be done, could lead in any number of different subject matter directions. But as well as having a joke at Lenin's expense, I think we all know Jared is also inviting us to take the long view of some of the challenges facing our nation. I'm sure you'll be relieved to hear that I won't attempt to list, discuss, or prioritise my view of everything that I think needs to be done. I will try and follow in the footsteps of so many who've come before the Sydney Institute and lay out a long-term vision that extends beyond the immediate election cycle to the challenges of the decades ahead. But because I won't be discussing everything, it means salient topics won't be mentioned tonight, like tax reform or economic management. That doesn't distract from their critical importance. It's merely because I want to avoid at all costs, as you will, a recreation of the 2020 summit, something that will surely send you for the X's. So instead I tend to take the liberty of focusing narrowly, as Andrew has done, on one single area of long-term reform whose difficulty is directly proportional to its significance. A reform agenda so singularly significant that many other public policy issues flow from it. An agenda that, if ignored, will impair our economy and our society in the future. And as I said, my focus will not be the months ahead, not even the years ahead, really, but the decades ahead. And I hope to plant a few seeds for discussion that we must have about the shape of our nation by about mid-century. To this end, I'll transcend the normal hurly-burly of partisan give and take, because this isn't about the next election, it's about the next generation. And after all, Andrew and I meet back in Canberra in only a week's time anyway. What I'll endeavour to do is look way ahead through a pair of policy binoculars to where we want to be, where we need to be, and perhaps how we can get there. We all understand that productivity growth is a key speed limit on our future prosperity. We all understand that, all other things being equal, the more productive we are, the better off we are. Whilst discussions of productivity naturally revolve around infrastructure and, of course, industrial relations, as important and as obvious as these are, there are other critical drivers of future productivity. And as I broach one of these tonight, I do so in the full knowledge that I'm leaping forth into a paddock that has more sacred cows in it than a Devondale dairy farm. There's little doubt that education is vital to future national productivity. One study found that enhanced educational attainment can trigger growth of up to 20% in output per worker. International achievement tests show that an increase in student academic performance by a single standard point of deviation can add one additional percentage point to GDP growth. There's nothing revolutionary about these findings. They're pretty common sense, I think you'd all agree. The best certain investment for future national opportunity and prosperity is in the platform, or should I say, in the springboard that is a well-educated nation. A first-class education system will grow over time a first-class productive capacity and place us in the best position possible to deal with the challenges, to seize the opportunities and deliver economic well-being to the greatest number of Australians. A first-rate education system provides the attributes and the attitudes required to thrive in the ever-shifting tableau that is the modern globalised economy. An economy in which both employers and employees must be nimble enough to keep pace with changing technology and savvy enough to embrace new ways of doing business. So how are we faring in this global education race? Better than many countries, but not as well as we did in the past. In fact, the recent findings of the Program for International Student Achievement, known as the PISA, make for pretty sobering reading. In the three subject areas tested, literacy, maths and science, Australian students were significantly outperformed by countries ranging from mainland China through South Korea to Canada and Finland. Some might find solace in the fact that our children scored a bit higher than average on these tests, but in this world of hyper-competition where our heels are constantly being nipped by those seeking to supplant and supersede us, anyone who seeks consolation in mediocrity is on a pilgrimage to the false comfort of fools. So how do we do better? How can we create more schools that will enable more of our young people to be the very best they can be? Some argue the solution is simply a matter of dollars and cents. They contend that more money is needed to improve our schools and boost academic achievement. But there's a body of growing empirical evidence that disputes the more money equals better results hypothesis. A recent article in the Australian Economic Review noted that between 2000 and 2009, the average level of government spending per state school pupil throughout Australia grew in constant dollar value from just over $11,000 to just over $13,000, an increase of about 17%. And what did we get for that increase? Not a lot, if we look at the PISA scores over the same period, which fell slightly by around 2.5%. Another study co-written by some bloke named Andrew Lee found that the real dollar value per child government school expenditure throughout Australia increased by a whopping 258% between 1964 and 2003. Yet despite this increased funding, this study found there was a small but statistically significant fall in numeracy. As noted, sociologist Frank Ferrutti wrote in last week's Australian, "Those addicted to throwing money at the problem need to face up to the fact that increased spending on education in Australia has coincided with a fall in student performance." And where did all these new dollars go? Much of it went into reducing class sizes along with other investments. But on class sizes, some educational theorists have turned this into something of a fetish. Over the 1964 to 2003 timeframe, the average number of students per Australian classroom shrank from around 36 to 26. But as we've seen, lowering the number of pupils per teacher has not proved a panacea to our educational ills. As the ranks of our teachers have swelled, the academic achievement of our children has stagnated. So what then is the recipe for reversing these doldrum decades in Australian student achievement? Now, of course, the topic has been much discussed in the media of late with editorials and columns on solutions ranging from curriculum reform to teacher bonus payments. But to my mind, one of the most important antidotes to our educational malaise is found in the single issue of teacher quality. Put simply, we know, don't we, that great teachers make a great difference in the lives of children. I believe this because I was lucky enough to be taught by some of them, even though I'm sure they didn't feel lucky at the time. And as a Member of Parliament, as I'm sure Andrew has, I've met many, many more. There's no doubt we have many gifted, impassioned and dedicated teachers working hard in schools throughout Australia. But there's also no doubt we don't have enough gold medal worthy teachers. Not enough of them begin a teaching career, and of those that do, not enough of them stay. And if we're honest, we'll also admit that the teaching profession isn't attracting enough of the intellectual elite of our university-bound youth. We see this in the university admission statistics. A place in Monash University Bachelor of Laws requires an enter score of just over 98, while the education course a score of just over 70. Similar disparities in academic achievement are replicated at universities throughout the country. It's undeniable that teacher quantity has come at the expense of teacher quality. Now, as a Liberal, I believe that people respond rationally to incentives. And one of the most important incentives at our disposal is money. Now, at this point, you'll be thinking I'm caught on the horns of my own self-contradiction. After all, wasn't I saying just a few minutes ago that money isn't the answer? Let me dispel this confusion. I'm not opposed to spending more on education per se. I merely object to pouring new money after old into a stale and stagnant enterprise. To do so strikes me akin to Albert Einstein's famous definition of insanity, trying to do the same thing over and over while expecting a different result. I'm not against higher pay for teachers. In fact, if we want to get our smartest uni graduates into the classroom and keep them there, we'll have to pay them very well indeed. But there must be strings attached. And I think it's only appropriate that higher levels of salary should be matched by higher levels of performance. I've been impressed by the reformist ideas of Michelle Ray, who formerly presided over the problem-plagued Washington DC public school system in the United States. One of her most dynamic reform proposals provided for increasing teacher salaries to up to US$130,000, if and only if they agreed to forego tenure. The idea was that the absence of a rigid tenure-based seniority system would allow superior performance in the classroom to be recognised and rewarded. And Ms. Ray's plan allowed teachers to opt out of her reform pay scheme and remain in the old system, where they'd earn roughly half as much. It was an innovative and pragmatic proposal. The local teachers' unions fought it tooth and nail, claiming her political scalp in the process. Another way of attracting top-notch talent into the system is through the Teach for Australia and fast-track mid-entry programs. Modelled on a similar scheme in America, Teach for Australia outflanks the bureaucratic morass by fast-tracking some of our highest-achieving uni graduates into some of our lowest-achieving schools, and with outstanding results. And as Carolyn Milburn noted in yesterday's Age, Australia abounds with accomplished professionals who'd be interested in a second career as educators if there weren't so many procedural hoops in the way. Now, it's true the Gillard government has just proposed its own bonus scheme for teachers who go the extra yard, to quote Education Minister Peter Garrett. And while this plan might look good at first glance, in reality, it's nothing more than a facade. It's bad enough that the sums involved, up to $10,000 for a mere handful of teachers nationwide, are paltry. And even worse, the selection criteria for the payment of these bonuses so subjective and vague. Last week in the Sydney Morning Herald, education expert Dr. Kevin Donnelly dismissed this Gillard government initiative as an exercise in bureaucratic red tape and educational mumbo-jumbo. Many, of course, would say this is a step in the right direction. But my point is, a step won't do. Incremental improvement doesn't take us where we need to go. I'm talking about something much bigger in scale and approach. We need to pay truly excellent teachers truly excellent wages. $120,000, $130,000 a year, even salaries as high as $150,000 for those very rare exceptional educators who not only teach their students so well but who teach and mentor their colleagues to be as great a teacher as they've become. After all, haven't we become accustomed to public servants earning that much and more at federal, state and local government level? But only on the condition that we adopt honest, objective measures to separate the best from the rest. And the most effective way to distinguish the excellent from the average is to measure the competence of teachers by the academic competence of the students they teach. Objective testing of individual student achievement over time must be the primary benchmark for measuring effectiveness. But such common sense policies of educational reform have faced unyielding opposition from teacher unions that display less openness and flexibility than even a medieval craftsman's guild. In fact, I think it's fair to say that teacher unions have come to constitute the biggest obstacle to substantive education reform, not just in Australia, but in the US and the UK as well. And no one provides a more compelling example of this than Catherine Birbalsing, an Oxford-educated teacher who was brought out to Australia on a speaking tour last year by the Sydney Institute. Put simply, Catherine was driven from her job for having the temerity to speak truth to power. She roused the ire of the British educational establishment with a speech to the 2010 Tory Party conference in which she denounced the English state school system as fundamentally broken. A system that, in her words, conspired to keep poor children poor through politically correct policies steeped in what George Bush once described as the soft bigotry of low expectations. In an article in the UK Daily Telegraph, Birbalsing described the noxious nexus that exists between pugnacious unions and a mendacious educational bureaucracy. These unions paint themselves as the working man's saviour when all they do is degrade the teaching profession by ensuring that bad teachers remain in their post and give the rest of us a bad name. In the last 40 years, only 18 teachers have lost their jobs for incompetence, she wrote. So how would we pay for this massive boost to the salaries of outstanding teachers? One way would be for state governments to forego the services of some of the teachers who are not so outstanding. That is, to have fewer teachers overall. The record shows that our children are much better served by larger classes taught by the excellent than by smaller classes taught by the mediocre. The fact that fewer children are sitting in a classroom doesn't really matter if their teacher isn't up to the job. And with that in mind, we must empower our school leaders and school communities to recruit the smartest and most talented people around. But our principals must not only be able to hire the best teachers around, they must also be empowered to weed out substandard teachers before they commit the fraud of stealing a child's future. My colleague Christopher Pyne, as Shadow Education Minister, has been advocating just this sort of enhanced school autonomy. Anything else is an exercise in self-deception. So when the Australian Education Union describes the push for teacher accountability as an assault on public schools, I describe it back as an assault on teacher protectionism. In the end, it all comes down to one simple question. Are our children in school to serve the teachers, or are our teachers in school to serve our children? I want to see schools that attract as many of the sharpest and smartest to service in classrooms as possible. And that means schools where skill triumphs seniority. Schools that fill children with knowledge and skills and with inspiration and aspiration. Throughout history, it's been crises that most often serve as the engine of serious reform. It's only when nations are confronted with a serious problem posing serious threats that they often summon up the critical mass required to inflict short-term pain for long-term gain. Now, it's true our public school system isn't entirely broken, or busted, as my five-year-old son would tell me. It's slowly coasting downwards, though. It's slowly losing altitude year by year. And it's the very gradual nature of the decline that makes grasping this reform more difficult. Yet this is our challenge, to summon up the will to revolutionise our education system when our schools aren't catastrophic, but merely not as good as they could be, should be, or will need to be in the decades ahead. And we must, because in the fast-paced competitive world of this century, to be second rate will be to stagnate, and to stagnate will be to wither. And if we wish to wax and not wane as a nation, we must be prepared to rock a few boats, raise a few hackles, upset a few vested interests, and fly in the face of a few dogmas. When assessing such matters, I find it useful to consider what I've come to call the Founding Fathers' Test. At the time of Federation, when the nation was being imagined, carved, and crafted, would it have been a deliberate future policy ambition to achieve the level of teacher quality that we have today? This is a task that defies arbitrary political distinctions between federal, state, and territory governments. From Cairns to Kalgoorlie, from Darwin to Devonport, it's a task that will require all of us to address a problem that affects us all nationally. All of us will have to agree and persevere in this common cause. At the end of the day, we're all charged with the responsibility to preserve and promote our national prosperity. And in closing, it's often been said that states are laboratories of democracy. And some of our states are leading the way. In Western Australia, the Barnett government's Independent Public Schools Initiative allows schools to set their own strategic directions, have authority for day-to-day decision-making, as long as high academic standards are achieved. It may well be one state one day will be emboldened to cast aside its rigid seniority-based pay structure and use higher wages to poach the best classroom teachers from other states. Yet we can't expect the states to do all of this alone, because education has such profound national economic implications as well. This is why the Commonwealth must also play a leading role in the coming decades. How, what, when and where should be open for discussion. But first we must have a sustained debate that will spur sufficient public demand for real change. Ladies and gentlemen, I have no illusions. What I propose is a considerable task that will take considerable effort over considerable time. But I was once told of an inspirational rabbinic saying that comes from the Talmud: it's not incumbent upon you to complete the work, but neither are you at liberty to desist from it. So in that spirit, let us begin on what is to be done. Thank you very much.
So thanks to both our speakers for fine presentations. I should also say thanks to Cause Chambers with us for the use of this facility tonight, this great facility. And we'll finish no later than 7 and then head off for a Grange or a biscuit or, following Robin Williams, perhaps something else. Yes. So we come to questions and discussion. Can I just start off, just give you a chance to recap? Andrew Lee, as I understand it, you're actually focusing on progressive taxation as a way of overcoming inequality. So you're sort of looking at the top. You're looking at teaching kids who aren't well taught at the moment. So you're looking at the bottom. Does that reflect your ideology or just how you've experienced things in your time in Parliament? Just some brief responses and we move on.
I mean, I think that's nicely summed up. There's also an interplay between the two topics in that one of the real challenges for the teaching profession is that a flat salary schedule looks much less attractive in a world of high earnings inequality, where the gap in most occupations between the best and the worst performers has risen than it did in the much more much more equal labour market of the 1970s. So there's a funny way in which the problem I've described has in some sense fed the problem that Tony's described.
You want to make a brief response?
Yeah, very briefly. Well, look, just on the teaching aspect of that. I mean, one of the problems has been that teachers start on a reasonable salary, but by a very young age, that is by definition younger than us, Andrew, many of them have peaked. And all of us know in our communities of teachers that make that mid-career change. I suppose what I'm trying to explore is a number of things, is improving that quality so that we can improve, to answer Jared's question, equality of opportunity. And to do that through a number of ways, to do that from those going into the teaching profession at a straight out of school, but recognising that getting mid-career entry is something that we accept in almost every other profession, but it seems too foreign to the teaching profession.
Okay, so we move on. There's a question. Here. Can we get the microphone? You know, need to stand up, because we've got a camera down the back there, so if you don't just stand. No, here. But Michael, here.
I was just going to ask about the Teach Next program, because you sort of were quite critical of it, but but the Gillard government has actually managed to sort of tackle, I guess, the teachers union and get this program in, and it is a starting point, so I just wanted you to expand on what your views are on that.
Look, now there's a good question, and I acknowledge it's a step, but if you look at the teacher's salary structure as it is at the moment, and as I just said in the last answer, you know, just to illustrate that a bit more, once you've been in the teaching profession for a decade or so, which means you might be 30, that's the point at which many start to leave. And what we really need is a more vertical structure for the most excellent teachers. What I'm saying is that I don't think what's being proposed, which is really just a brick on top, is the sort of fundamental change that's going to get that cultural change we need, where we get, you know, the best and the brightest saying, I want to be a teacher, and the best and the brightest who go into teaching. There are still many who could do many other professions, but all the empirical evidence is we don't keep many of them. And it's not about high pay for every teacher. It's about very high pay for the very good teachers. So what do I mean? I think to answer your question specifically, what would I see in a school? I would see, obviously, a principal very well paid and a number of lead teachers, which I referred to in the speech, not only as excellent teachers in the key areas within the school, but teacher teachers as well. And instead of having this flatter structure, which is fine for those who aren't aspiring to be the very best when there's so much else on offer, I suppose.
And do you want to make a brief response?
I think I did a paper recently for CESIFO Journal looking at the economics and politics of teacher merit pay. So had a chance to go through and have a look at all of the studies that have been done on evaluations of merit pay schemes. And you get a sense from that anyone who tells you that merit pay always works or always fails hasn't spent enough time looking at it. It's pretty hard to find a merit pay system that works well, but I think it is possible. So the New York evaluation goes down in flames. There's one in Andhra Pradesh that goes terrifically. There's a Tennessee one that goes down. There's a Texas one that works well. So it's the nuances in how you design it. And I found it's the trade-off between a simple metric, which everyone can understand, such as we will just pay you for your test scores, and a metric that captures much of what we're trying to do in teaching, which is, of course, far broader than test scores. Test scores are something we care about, but not the only thing we care about. So it's hard, but I share Tony's optimism that it's doable. The Brumby government had some randomised trials of teacher merit pay plans in its final days, and I think that was a really, really useful way of approaching the problem.
Just very briefly, Jared, yeah. I mean, one thing I didn't cover, there's a range of issues here, but one I didn't cover for reasons of time is, you know, and this is not to blame any side of politics. In fact, each side could share the blame over 20, 30 years as society's changed. But it is an absolute madness that in our states that the best teachers who tend to become the principals have the financial incentive to leave at about the age of 55, which might have made sense in the past, but I know, and I know Andrew will know, and many of you here will know, great teachers who are great principals, but at the age of 55, the way the state superannuation system works, they all leave, basically, whereas we're talking and preaching about people remaining in the workforce longer. So there's a range of things that I haven't gone into tonight for the risk of recreating the 2020 okay. summit.
Question here, we've got to be brief, and then we're going over there.
Yes, my question is to Mr. Lee. You mentioned in your address that a more progressive income tax rates are needed to fix the inequality problem and also more services. My question is that wouldn't higher personal income tax rates on the higher income earners cause disincentive to create and produce, and which means less growth, less employment, and less government revenue for the services that you've been stating? For example, okay. you mentioned health, whatever. A smaller, we've seen both in the okay. past and in history.
Thanks. Yeah. Question about disincentives.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
So, Raymond, I think your point on the disincentive effects on taxation is absolutely right. I should be clear, the long-form version of my paper, which if you didn't get on the way in, you can get on the way out, is quite clear in saying that I'm not arguing for the top tax rate to go up. The point I was making on taxes is the one that Ken Henry was making, which is that if you want progressivity, the personal income tax scale is the way to do it. The tax and transfer system is the way to do it, not the GST, not the company tax, not a range of other taxes. They're a much less efficient way of achieving the goal of progressivity than the personal income tax system. So I'm sorry that I didn't go into that in as much detail, and I agree with you on disincentive effects of taxation.
So hang on, we've
got to
go on. Yep.
John. Thanks, Andrew and Tony. Can I ask you back on education about, I guess, generally the whole complex around curriculum standards and priorities? And I speak as someone who went to a Catholic primary school, a state high school, and with a son in a state school. First thing I remember sort of learning was how to read, write, and add up. I think my son probably learned about recycling. His first things. Which may be fine, as long as he's learning the other stuff as well.
So he puts the bins out, doesn't he?
Not yet. And I guess, and it sort of looks back to Andrew's point about inequality as well, because, I mean, how do you avoid a situation where guilty middle-class parents are pulling their kids out of state schools at year five and paying $15,000, $20,000 a year because they're cracked? And that, to me, is where you both sort of join up in terms of education and inequality. Mm. So can I both, I guess, ask you to comment about the curriculum software and the priorities that yep. the excellent teachers, which we all know we need,
yep.
are actually going to teach?
All right.
These are good questions, but I've got to ask you to be brief with your response.
All right. Well, we're not very good at that, each of us, but we'll try.
You're involved.
Look, why don't I address then, Jared, one part of it, which is the curriculum bit, and leave the other bit to you. I mean, the national curriculum is a great policy aim. We had it as an aim. The current government's got it as an aim. But what's implicit in it is that there is a quality national curriculum. And I remember a few years ago, I actually had some sympathy for the New South Wales Labor government. I can't remember what area it was in. It might have been history, I think. Where and they were fighting with the newly elected Rudd government. Jared will correct me if I'm wrong. Because they said, well, it's fine to agree to this national standard, but in this area we would be dropping our standard here in New South Wales. That's the difficulty, and that's the difficulty of the whole area. And that's why I've chosen it, really, because it is these areas around COAG that are very difficult but need a long-term approach. I mean, the problem hasn't arisen overnight. In terms of the short answer to your question, I'll hand over to Andrew. I think that principal autonomy is key. I really do, and school community autonomy. I think from that so much flows, but they need the tools, which is very much what I was talking about tonight.
Andrew?
So Tony was kind enough to mention the work that Chris Ryan and I did looking at the stagnation of Australian test scores over the last generation. We searched around at the end of that paper for possible reasons. One that Tony's mentioned is that the story of the last quarter century is class sizes fall 10%, teacher salaries relative to other occupations fall 10%. That could be one thing. But another could be the one that you talk about, which is this move from phonics to whole language and then back to phonics again. That could well be an explanation for the stagnation of literacy scores. We just don't have enough evidence on that. But to again draw one of the links between the two topics, which I think turn out to be curiously well matched, if you have uniform salary schedules across a jurisdiction, teachers then sort across schools based not on what a school can pay, because a disadvantaged school can't buy a high-quality teacher, but they sort on the non-wage benefits. And it is a majority of teachers who would prefer to be teaching in more advantaged schools. They're just easier environments to teach. So the effect of a uniform salary schedule is actually that more experienced teachers end up teaching the most affluent children. And I think that's the opposite of what equality of opportunity would lead us towards.
So there's a question here. You can just start.
Okay. Well, it seemed to me that one of the important things in our society in the last couple of hundred years, Western society, has been this imagination, a sort of creativity coming from imagination and seeing what to do with things. And that seems to be most important. I mean, when you look at the Chinese inventing spinning, apparently not doing it, and then the English inventing the same sort of industrialised spinning, getting out around the world to get...
Okay, so you're talking about the need for creativity.
Well, that imagination.
So how do you get imagination society into all this? Apart from imagining and putting out the bins tomorrow.
I can have a crack for it.
Yes.
Yeah, have a go. I'll have a go.
So this partly comes down to that question of how you want to measure teacher performance. If you have a very narrow measure, it's going to do a bad job of capturing creativity. If you have teacher performance measured by the principal, you might capture a teacher's ability to instill a sense of creativity in a child, but then you have other complications like principals playing favourites. It hits the nail on the head as to why teacher merit pay is interesting but difficult.
I think, and this will be a very short answer, Jared, you'd be pleased. I think part of the answer is the importance of a broad education. I think if you look back at successful societies, I mean, how do you grapple with these challenges? Well, I had a sentence in there about, you know, you make this investment, it places you in the best possible shape to deal with whatever challenges follow. And I think having a broad education stemming from high quality teachers is the best answer.
I think this might be our last question. This question over here.
Thanks for your talk tonight. It's been illuminating. I have a vested interest, being a teacher for 30 years. I've retired. But I've just got a question for both of you, from both sides, in a sense. One of the most important things in terms of jobs is that people start in careers, you know, the 10, 20, 30 types of careers, 40 types of careers. Their jobs vary and change, and that's the instrument to keeps them interested, that's the instrument that makes them strive to be better. When you're teaching in a school of 1,000 students, 60 teachers do the grunt work. They're doing the work all the time in the school. After 20 years of doing exactly the same thing, it is very hard to remain the principled gold medal teacher that you people aspire us to be. We need to rethink what teachers are doing and where they can go after teaching for, say, 5 or 6 years to do different things, to change their style.
Right,
that's
fine. Yep.
What do you think about that?
What do you think?
I think it's a good point. I mean, I probably didn't articulate it well enough. I mean, in answer, I think, to your question, Joanna, I said that we curiously expect people who become teachers at the age of 21 or 22 never to leave, but we know that people change other careers, and it may well be that we're not expecting to keep every gold medal teacher, but that's why the mid-career entry is important. And I think
you know, you've made a suggestion about how you sustain that in a professional sense, and that's got to be part of the debate.
Andrew?
I agree with Tony on Teach Next and Teach for Australia. I mean, if I had one quibble with his speech, I think it is that he undersells the extent to which the current government is doing many of the things that that he wants to see. But I think the question also brings out that subtle interplay between the flexibility of the curriculum and the talents of the teacher. Noel Pearson has a lovely quarterly essay last year where he essentially comes to the conclusion that getting superstar teachers to Cape York will not be possible, and therefore it is better to focus on a curriculum which is like direct instruction, which is much more rigid, but which offers less risk of the educational experience going wrong. I think it's provocative at the very least.
Many thanks. Look, there are other questions, but we're right on time, so I think we'll have to call it quits there. Can I just say thanks to both of our speakers? Their longer papers will be published in the Sydney Papers online, and we asked them tonight to keep their comments to around 15 minutes each, which they did, and they've been brief in their responses. I mean, these days you hear a lot of criticism about our politicians, but here tonight we've seen two of our younger politicians, one Labor, one Liberal, talking in a very coherent manner, having done a lot of work in the papers that they've prepared across a range of issues, and very thoughtful comments looking not to the next election but well beyond the next election to perhaps the next generation. So I think it's been a fine performance by both Dr. Lee and Mr. Smith tonight. We're very pleased they delivered their papers here. It'd be great to have their papers up on our podcast, their talks up on our podcast tomorrow, their papers published in time. APAC's here from Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar, and they'll be recording this too. So for tonight, many thanks to both of you. Well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.